Hello and welcome to Making Media Now, the Filmmakers Collaborative Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Azevedo. On this episode, I'm chatting with Noam Osband and Sebastian Diaz, the co-directors and co-producers of a documentary called A Thousand Pines. So remember just a few short years ago when toilet paper suddenly became one of our most sought-after products. Remember the lines? The limits to how much you could purchase? Well, toilet paper is made of paper, obviously, and that paper comes from wood, and that wood comes from trees, lots and lots and lots of trees. Wood and wood products are the biggest natural resources used and produced in America. Every year, hundreds of crews travel the country to plant pine trees. A considerable amount of those crews are made up of Latino workers, here on temporary visas. A Thousand Pines documents the stories of one of these Latino crews. The film, which will be broadcast on the PBS series Independent Lens on April 1st, documents the lives of migrants who depend on the controversial guest worker visa program. The film follows a crew of workers from Mexico over the course of a season, planting trees throughout the United States. The crew struggles to balance the job's physical demands and its extreme isolation while remaining connected to their families back home. As the season progresses, they become a small family, cooking and caring for each other in order to endure the punishing work. The film centers on the crew foreman, Raimondo Morales, who's in his 19th season working for the largest reforestation company in the U.S. When he began, he was single and had few responsibilities. Now, however, he must balance his obligations to his wife, his children, and his elderly mother with a heart condition, while also tending to the needs and the emergencies of the planting crew. Spending only 3 months at home during the off-season, Raimondo's job is both the family's salvation and its heartbreak. Here's the film's trailer.
Una vez que dejes tu casa, tierras ajenas, es muy difícil.
Y ahora que lejos, me encuentro sin luz, sin amor.
Cuando ya no los tiene uno, con el alma quisiera uno que sea verlos.
Making Media Now is sponsored by Filmmakers Collaborative, a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting media makers from across the creative spectrum. From providing fiscal sponsorship to presenting an array of informative and educational programs, Filmmakers Collaborative supports creatives at every step in their journey. To learn more, visit filmmakerscollab.org. And as always, if you're enjoying this podcast, please do like, follow, and you can even leave a 5-star review. It makes a huge difference. Now on to my conversation with Noam Osband and Sebastian Diaz. Hello and welcome to Making Media Now, Sebastian Diaz and Noam Osband.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Yeah, good to be here.
Good to be speaking with each of you. And for our listeners' benefits, not that you're going to be able to tell through our conversation, but Noam is joining us from Philadelphia and Sebastian is joining us from Northern California. So it is really good to be speaking with both of you about your film, A Thousand Pines, which will premiere on PBS on April the 1st. And my first question was, I was curious how this story about Raimondo Morales and his crew of planters came to your collective attention, your individual attention, and the process that each of you went through in deciding that this is something that we want, this is a story we want to follow and a documentary that we want to make.
So I'd say there's two parts to this answer, and I'll give part one and then Sebastian will give part two. So I'm the one who found the story. Arkansas is like a second home to me, which seems unlikely for a Jewish kid from Boston, but I did Teach for America and I taught high school in Arkansas after college and sort of fell in love with the state and go back every year. In fact, I'm going back next week. And I was working on a a PhD in anthropology. And when I started my PhD in anthropology, my first semester, I was like, I hate academic writing. Why am I doing this? And then I took a filmmaking course and I fell in love with it. And so I started making films in graduate school and making documentary films. And I petitioned to be able to have my dissertation be a documentary film. And they accepted. It was the first one at Penn. And I knew I wanted to study immigration. My plan was to study immigration to Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a summer in Arkansas in the Ozarks. And I'm friends with a lot of these like back to landers, older hippies in the Ozarks. And so I was there for the summer and I was researching things about immigration to Arkansas. So I was spending time with a Spanish language church or visiting community organizations that deal with the Latino population there. But all these old hippies would be like, oh, you should study tree planting. We used to do it. And now it's all Latino. And that wasn't the plan at all when I went down there. But by the end of the summer, I thought, oh, this is a really interesting story, partly because nobody knows anything about tree planting, right? Even though the U.S. is the world's biggest producer and consumer of wood products and industry plants over 1.5 billion trees a year, almost nobody knows what we're talking about when we say tree planting. They think of it as like a crunchy granola-like sustainability thing and not like, no, this is how you get toilet paper. And also the fact that the owners of these companies, including the one who we ended up following a crew from, that they used to be planters themselves, and there are these hippies and then sort of turned into business people. And I thought, oh my God, that's such a unique angle. So for my dissertation, I spent time with this group of Oaxacan guest workers in the U.S. I spent time with American citizens who plant. There's not like a lot of them, but there's a world of American citizens who do migrant work, many of whom, most of whom are actually college educated, but sort of want that lifestyle. And time in Canada, where if we were Canadian, everybody would know what tree planting is. It's this beloved rite of passage that you do during the summers in college. And so I made a 3-hour documentary, the Lawrence of Arabia of dissertations, about that. And then when I finished, I thought, you know, there's the footage to make something that's a more conventional doc. For that film, I had like footnotes on screen and I narrated it using academic language. So you could watch it and get it, but it was not meant, you know, for a wide audience. It was meant for my dissertation committee or academics. And I thought it would be interesting to try to turn this into something else. And I knew that it would take time in assembling a team. At the time, I was living in New York City, and I was looking for collaborators, and I especially wanted to work with somebody who was Mexican, who I thought did, you know, bring a different sort of sensibility to it. And Sebastian and I were both in this group called the Brooklyn Documentary Club, and I invited him over to my apartment one time to watch a lot of this Lawrence of Arabia of dissertations to see if he wanted to be a part of it, and he was willing to.
I moved to New York for a residency program for documentary at a place called Union Doc. So I had been there since 2012, and meeting Noam, looking at what he had filmed as an immigrant myself, I, you know, connected immediately to the subject matter. As a documentarian, as an immigrant, but also what really resonated to me, because there's many films about immigration and Latino immigrants, even like there's many films that have documentaries that have been done. But what was very special to me, striking, was the intimacy that Noam captured. The other aspect was the very new thing to me about the particular kind of visa, which is temporary guest working visa. I'd heard about them, but I didn't know much. And so this new angle of immigration was very interesting, knowing that while on one hand you have, yes, the advantage to go back home to Mexico and be reunited with your families every year, at the same time, the sacrifice of being away from them for 8 to 9 months a year, year and year, over and over, it's quite the sacrifice. And also the living conditions of this itinerant kind of job, where they go from hotel to hotel, working from the south of the U.S. to the Midwest through this nine-month planting season. So Yeah, it just struck me as something very unique about tree planting that we don't really stop to think about where our paper and wood products come from. And it's this workforce that are doing it, planting in an average of 2,000 to 3,000 pines per day per person, which was just insane to me to see. I mean, they're baby trees, right? Saplings, but that's right. A lot.
Right. And as the film shows, they're carrying these saplings around on these huge, these bags, these sacks that they are trudging through these forests and these fields with. I want to talk just for a moment about that guest worker visa program. And Sebastian, as you mentioned, there are lots of documentaries about immigration. It's a big, gnarly, often unwieldy topic that I think a lot of times the terminology within the topic gets confused. So for the benefit of our listeners, how is the guest worker visa program defined? What are the constraints around it? And how is it essentially monitored and managed from a governmental level?
So the guest worker program is people who have visas that have a temporary sort of status to them, right? So it's not like a green card. There's a whole variety of different sorts of visas. So some are for people who are quote unquote skilled workers, right? People who are, let's say, doctors or other things. Others are for fields that are sort of like unique fields. So like to be a model, you need a guest worker visa if you want to come work in the U.S. These are considered, you know, quote unquote, low skill jobs, which I sort of hate the terminology because there's obviously a skill to it. But to use the terminology, low skill jobs, there's H-2A and H-2B. H-2A is agricultural work. So farm workers. H-2B is non-agricultural work. Tree planters are considered H-2B, which is not necessarily intuitive, but so it is. And everything is sort of run by the Department of Labor. It's like a wicked complex topic. So the Department of Labor determines what your wage is. But what your wage is supposed to be the prevailing wage. I mean, that's the term. So it's like what the going rate is. And it's different by county, and the Department of Labor determines that. And the idea is that you want to give the prevailing wage to not depress wages for native born workers. You know, in the particulars of these workers, a big difference is H-2A workers can switch employers. So if you are here on farm work and your employer is screwing around with you, you can go to a different employer. H-2B workers are not allowed to change employers. And that creates a real power imbalance because your only options are to continue working for the employer who maybe you think is not paying you the right amount or lying about your hours or harassing you, or you can go back to your country of origin. In theory, you're not allowed to pay, for a visa, but in the real world, people do all the time, right? People take out loans for their visa. So to go back home, you know, especially if you've taken out a loan, you know, is bad. And so, you know, in some ways, like these workers have real constraints, right? Because, you know, to the group that we often think of as sort of being the most legally perilous, undocumented workers, if you're undocumented, you can switch employers, right? I mean, it's sort of all under the table. So it doesn't, and obviously you face a lot of systemic challenges. But if you're an H-2B worker, on some level, you're trying to work within the system, right? You've chosen for a variety of reasons to do it in the legal way. So If you can't change employers, you really are at a disadvantage if you're being screwed around with. And this is something which has been a problem in sort of all the industries that use H-2B workers generally.
Well, thank you for providing that context. And I don't want to give the wrong impression. Your film could not be further from a dry academic treatment of the various immigration issues that you were just touching upon. There are no talking heads. There's not a single quote unquote expert, who's giving a proclamation of how things work. And as Sebastian pointed out, the film is a very intimate film. And we at the center of this intimate film is Raimundo Morales. Tell me about Raimundo. How did you find him, and how did you win over his trust and the trust of his crew to spend so much time with them and to get them to sort of, you know, reveal so many elements of their personalities, their concerns, their hopes, their fears.
Yeah. So I met Raimundo the day before they left. His brother is like one of the recruiters, and both have worked with Superior for ages. So when Superior knew I was going to go around with the crew, I almost was like basically assigned to him. I don't think they put any real intentional thinking into like which crew I'd be with. And so I went over to his house. My Spanish, I would say, is highly conversational now. I'm not fluent, but at the time it was definitely not there. And so, you know, I met him and all, and then the next day sort of showed up with a camera and two busloads of people. And it definitely was somewhat uncomfortable. You know, I'd say like throughout the time of shooting, when I was doing shooting film for my dissertation, I frequently would be in these places where people are not expecting a camera. So I remember like with the American Citizens Who Plant, I met them because I knew the owner, and then I show up and like all these guys are sitting around drinking in a hay barn. And then I showed up and I was like, hi, I'm an anthropologist who's going to hang out with you guys and take some film. And that's awkward. What I also didn't know at the time and would have made it even more awkward was that somebody had spread a rumor that I was like working undercover for the U.S. government when I met these guys and the buses were going to leave. Nobody told me, which is good because that would have made it really uncomfortable. You know, the plan was originally to plant and film at the same time. I planted for a couple weeks and like I just wasn't getting any filming done because it was so god-awfully exhausting. So then I stopped, which then in some ways made, you know, had this awkwardness of like these guys are busting their hump and I'm this student from a privileged background who like when it's raining can be in the van for some of the time. And so I'd say there's two main ways in which I sort of won over people's trust with that. One is, you know, I just think I sort of really committed and did what they did, and they sort of respected that. So I shared a bed with somebody just like everybody else did. And, you know, I didn't make my own separate food. Which to me, I should say, these things do not seem to me like big sacrifices in the scheme of things. Like it didn't feel, you know, it is not hard for me to live out of, you know, a hotel for some period of time or that. But I think, you know, the men were, I think, somewhat, you know, it's just touched that like I was going through the same thing they did. I also, after I stopped planting and I would be hanging out with them in the field, realized I had to do something to endear myself to them. And so I became El Aquador, the water boy, as they would call me. And I would fill up a bag with water bottles and walk around like twice a day and give people water. Cause you normally the water is where the, like the truck is. So if you're out in the field, you might not carry water with you cause you don't want it to be any heavier. And so if I'm walking around, bringing people water, then, you know, it makes you happy. And I'd say the last thing is just like through being there for a long period of time. So I was with them, like I said, in total for a little over half a year. And, you know, if you spend enough time, people, you know, slowly get used to having you around, slowly start to ignore the camera. And, you know, I think it was a sort of real anthropological way of doing it where, you know, participant observation is the phrase anthropologists use for their research method. And I think in this case, both the amount of time that I was with them, but also really sort of committing to the bit, made people comfortable with it.
I was going to just elaborate on like,
absolutely,
after joining, because for me as a filmmaker, this has been a very unique experience of coming onto a project as a co-director where everything has been shot pretty much. We did do together an additional trip for just a short week for pickup shots, but that's really all my involvement in terms of production. So I was really crafting the film in the edit room along with our editor, who we found through Latino Public Broadcasting's recommendation, who was one of our funders. And so Angela Reginato, Noam and me, going through the footage, started to scour through this hundreds of hours, well, over 100 hours of footage that Noam had captured, and trying to find what were vehicles to tell the story in an engaging way, especially when he wasn't shooting necessarily for his dissertation, thinking of crafting a story, right? Of following someone's narrative. So what we realized was that Raimundo, the foreman, that he sort of was assigned to by chance, he was very, the camera really liked him, so to speak. He was very approachable, very endearing, very open. and very experienced because he's been doing this for 20 years. So he was a great point of view to tell the story through. But then in two other people, two rookies, we had like a great contrast of people that are coming for the first time to do this job. And what are the reasons, their motivations, and their challenges, etc. So that's how what we decided, that he was going to be the protagonist. He became naturally sort of exposed to ourselves as like we are going to tell through Raimundo's point of view. And then as far as like what would be the narrative arc, we figured that the planting season itself was a natural arc from winter to winter. When they leave home, go through the whole seasons of the year, and then they come back home, reunite for 3 short months, and then go back to do it all over again.
Yes, and one of the things I think that is so affecting about the film is that as you're telling the story and documenting the story of the planters, running parallel to that is there are numerous instances where you're getting the take of what's happening back home, what's happening with the elderly parents, what's happening with the children, what's happening with the mothers and the wives who are holding down the fort while their husbands or their significant others are away for 8 months or so. In a similar vein, that type of connection, I would assume, had to have required a degree of trust and openness, and you certainly seem to have gotten that. Talk to me a little bit about how that came to be.
Yeah, I mean, I went back with the crew when they went back, which you see in the film, and then I visited everybody at their homes. And, you know, and we kept, you know, I guess I had, and Sebastian, once he joined, sort of kept in touch with people over time. And, you know, it's a funny story in a way in which, like, you know, maintaining relationships can help if you're a filmmaker. So one of the people in the film, Rodolfo, you know, helped him, you know, at one point when he came to New York and helped him, you know, be able to drove him to his father. And when he got married, I went to Mexico to film the wedding, which he was really happy about. And when I was there, I played some songs of Vicente Fernandez, who's this beloved Mexican singer that I can play some songs of. So I played it and people laughed. Fast forward like 8 years and we went to get pickup shoots, and he lives in a very small village where a lot of the men are not there because they're working, and we definitely and he had switched numbers, so we couldn't reach him on WhatsApp, and we sort of knew we needed to get some stuff from his house, but we hadn't been able to like get in touch with him to tell his wife we're going to be coming. So we pull up to this very small village, and there's an old woman who's like selling some candies at the entrance, and we ask her, you know, does she know where Araceli Morales, you know, the wife of Rodolfo, does she know where she lives? And she said she had no idea what we're talking about. And then she looked into the car and she was like, wait, you're the person who sang at his wedding. And I was like, that is me. Cause it's a village that I do not think it's many white Americans. And, if any, and so then once she recognized me, she was like, oh yeah, she lives, you know, and she told us how to get to where her house was. So, you know, I think, you know, if you mean, tame relationships and you're just sort of genuine and nice with people, you know, I think people have this instinct where they're often want to tell their story and are hoping somebody might ask them, you know, to talk. Not always, but often, and I think that all sort of helped.
Sebastian, when you first saw this huge assemblage of footage, you know, up to, I think you said 100 hours, and you knew that to craft this into a documentary film that is just a little bit over an hour long, actually, at least the version that is going to be playing on PBS, as a filmmaker and as an immigrant, were there any particular aspects of the story that felt primarily important that you thought need to come forward?
Yeah, certainly the sort of imbalance of workers that that did this originally, that were white Americans that used to do this kind of job as a way of an alternative lifestyle, kind of in surrounded by nature, but with their families along with them, you know, and camping out in the plantation sites, and then, you know, only working for an 8 to 9 month season. And then the radical change of fast forward to the 90s, and then when Noam filmed this, is that it's mostly immigrants on temporary work visas, but with very different conditions, living in motel rooms, 4 men per room, two men per bed, and cooking in the kitchen, in the bathrooms and stuff like that. So just kind of like the logic of capitalism, you know, in a way, but without this being explicitly political kind of commentary film, we kind of like put our bet in that if we just made this into an intimate portrait following the day-to-day life of these men during their planting season and then back home, one can make their own conclusions and assumptions of whether this seems to be a dignified lifestyle or not, whether this is a huge sacrifice that maybe not many Americans would want to do or not. And then also, if you have certain maybe conservative points of view about immigration, well, maybe you can realize that these men are only here to do a job and do a huge sacrifice for their families back home, and that the only thing that they want is to go back home and enjoy their families. They're not trying to steal anyone's job or opportunities here. And in fact, the American owners of the businesses speak to this, and how the only people that, and the most effective people that would be willing to do it for the increasingly lower salaries where the immigrant workforce, right? So
what was driving the reduction in the wages was competition among the various companies. And as Sebastian as you mentioned, this was originally sort of the back to the land movement. This was about self-sufficiency and, you know, work real hard for X amount of months per year and then take your money and, you know, not have to deal with society and the man. And then some time goes by and they become the man. And Noam, I thought that the film did a really good job of kind of, in a very subtle way, you have the voices of the company owners now, who really had different feelings or seemingly different feelings around what the demands of the market and capitalism led them to in terms of the nature of their labor force and how their labor force would be compensated. Did you have any restrictions or feel any restrictions around the company who Raimondo and Morales and his crew were working for? Did they have concerns about how much you showed, what you showed, and what you said?
No. I mean, they gave like some input about some things, like wanting to make clear about, you know, they now pay for the hotel rooms. Okay. At the time that it was filmed, the workers paid for their hotel rooms, so that, you know, they had asked about one shot that raised concerns because it looked like they were paying for the hotel rooms, but they, you know, were pretty off hands, and especially when I was filming, I mean, nobody sort of, I mean, I was like 1,000 miles away, and sort of doing my own thing. You know, it's interesting. When the film screened at the Hot Springs Doc Fest, I was worried about the reaction of Michael Economopoulos, who's in the film, who's one of the founders of Superior. And, it, you know, we create a foil with him and another one of these hippie owners who Mike stays in the business and ends up being very financially successful. And another owner is like, this is not what I wanted to do, and quit. And I was so worried about what he would think. And he saw, and when I saw him afterwards, he was like, you showed it as it is. And I think often, I mean, this is always, you know, if there's a company engaged in like serious misconduct, this isn't necessarily the case. But I think often if you're willing to sort of give like an honest portrayal, like, you know, people really be okay. I mean, similar but different. I made a movie once, a short film about a Jewish violent extremist in the West Bank. And it's the kind of film that I have watched and have shown to friends. And I think he comes across as kind of like a violent racist extremist. And he watched it and he thought, oh, this is accurate. You know, in some ways, I think like if you give people the honor of sort of just showing them how they are, often people are kind of okay with that.
And since you've completed the shooting and the editing and the packaging of the film, what have you come to know about the sort of the current status of any of the workers? Raimondo, is he still a planter? Is he still helping run a crew?
Well, yeah,
his two daughters are in university, which is something that has been really nice to learn.
Those little girls are in university now. Oh, that's wonderful. They were so cute. I loved their competing,
yeah.
Their competing reportage on what things were like at home when dad was away.
Yeah.
We fight all the time. No, we never fight. Okay, we fight a little. All right, we do fight all the time.
It's one of our favorite parts. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. We almost thought about having that as like a postscript in the film, being that like his daughter now will be the first in her family to go to college, but it just didn't feel like the right ending, and aesthetically sort of we chose against it. Incredibly, Raimondo stopped for a couple years and now he's actually restarted. So Raimondo continues to do this job, you know, which he's done the majority of his life, which is, you know, wild to me, but you know, it pays better than almost any job he would find back in his hometown.
The two rookies, Juan and Rodolfo, they're not planting anymore.
They are not, okay. And in wrapping up, I'm wondering, and I know these questions are always a little bit tough, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway. What would you want viewers to come away from this film with in terms of how they receive the experience?
Yeah. I'll say two things, and then I'm curious how you'll answer this, Sebastian. One is, you know, I view this film, and I have like increasingly come to this feeling over the process of editing it, as sort of like a love story, which is not, it is not really a love story in plot. But, you know, when I started making it, I didn't have kids. Now I have two kids. And the idea of like not being with them for 9 months as they're going through formative things. Like I left town for 10 days last month and could feel, you know, some degree of sadness over being away from them. And I think in some ways, this is really like a love story about what people do for their families, you know, and the sacrifices they're willing to endure. The other thing is, you know, I am happy that there are films that are sort of advocacy films and take a real sort of strong point of view. I think there's a bunch of reasons why we chose not to do that. But one of them is the hope that there'll be somebody, you know, when it airs on PBS on April 1st, that there's somebody who's watching it who maybe is not really much of a fan of immigrants and actually generally would not have any interest in watching this movie, but, you know, they just were watching TV and they decided not to change the channel and, you know, comes away from it with a more positive view of immigrants than when they started. And I think creating a film that has a more neutral presentation is more likely to change that view. You know, I think somebody who does not like immigrants, if they see a film that has like a very strong advocacy point of view, I just think will be like, this is liberal nonsense. But I think if you do something that's more verite and you just show people like, these people work hard just like you, these are people just trying to put food on the table and support their families just like you, I think it, you have the chance to humanize. And anytime you can humanize in other, I think it kind of softens people's views a little bit. And so that's another real takeaway that I'm hoping some people have.
Yeah, for myself, you know, at a time where we're seeing like cracking down of unions and like so much like labor issues in general in the US, not even dealing with immigrants at all, just in general, I feel like this film hopefully, like, you know, just continues to be part of that conversation of how we need to take better care of workers. That these guys are essential workers. You know, they're producing the paper and wood products that we all use in our everyday life, from toilet paper to the furniture that we, and the homes that we are in, right? So we just need to like do better with all of our workforce. skilled or unskilled, whatever you want to call them, but just like everyone deserves a dignified life. And, you know, in particular, in terms of immigration reform, that's a whole huge conversation as well. So, like, I think that the focus should be more, instead of like building a wall or whatever, which there's already like so many walls. I'm from Tijuana. There's like a three wall border. I mean, we do not need any more militarization of it. Like, it's just propaganda. Like, if they want to come in or stop them from coming in, that's already in place. So the reality is that we need the workforce, unless the U.S. is willing to not be extremely capitalist. So it's really a commentary and a philosophical question about capitalism at the end of the day. I'm all for capitalism, and that's all fine and good. But we need to just do better in terms of everyone, you know, the distribution of wealth. And when we talk particularly about the H-2B work visa, well, the disadvantages that we spoke about hopefully are also things that this film can bring to the table of them probably being able to change employers or things that are a little more fair and advantageous.
Well, the film is A Thousand Pines. It will be airing on April the 1st on PBS as part of the Independent Lens series. And I've been speaking with the co-producers and co-directors, Sebastian Diaz and Noam Osban. Thank you both for your time. I have enjoyed our conversation.
Cool. Thank Likewise. You so much.
We still are going on festivals, so if people want to check out the tiny bit longer version of festivals than the broadcast version, you can check that out on our website, 1000pinesfilm.com, for the different festivals that we have coming soon.
Excellent. I will make sure that there's a link to your website in the program notes of this particular podcast episode. Thank you again.